My next guest is...
Jesus Christ.
All right, enough. Is Max Blumenthal. Ladies and gentlemen. Max, where are you writing for now?
I am the editor.
Oh, wait a second. What's going on?
Can you hear me?
Oh, there we go.
I was worried Bombfell was going to be an arms contractor.
Yeah, that's not necessarily...
like bombs falling. What am I doing here? I am the editor of Alternet's Gray Zone Project, and it's... a special section at Alternet dedicated to challenging the push for military intervention in the Middle East and explaining and reporting on how our endless war on terror and our support for Israeli occupation has affected our politics domestically and is pushing us to the right.
And you got a book that's coming out soon, too. Is that right?
Well, I'm working on a book. It's still kind of in the draft phase.
Okay.
But, you know, trying to make sense of... why Trump happened, why Islamophobia became such a big factor in our politics, and, you know, what role our national security state played in fueling these. Before 9/11, going back all the way to 1979, when we initiated support for the Afghan Mujahideen, helped the CIA provided money for Osama bin Laden to build a network of tunnels along the Afghanistan-Pakistan border, which were just bombed last week by Donald Trump with the largest non-nuclear bomb ever dropped by the U.S. in history. So they're bombing the CIA's caves. And I'm writing about how this forever war has affected us back home, including in Europe. And it's clear, you know, that we have created one series of catastrophes in the Middle East after another, including... three major refugee crises from Iraq, Libya, and Syria, thanks to our interventions. And what has happened to the European politics? Why is Marine Le Pen surging? Why is Geert Wilders surging? Why are these far-right figures surging? It has a lot to do with the fact that we have basically generated refugee crises and put the clash of civilizations that, you know, used to be just kind of this fantasy on overdrive.
Right.
I'm kind of like saying too much.
Well, there was a lot I wanted to
unpack.
Like I kept
there.
I was going to stop you at different points. Let's sort of start from most recent and work back.
Yeah.
Because, and I want to just sort of flag this because I feel like there was a lull at one point. You know, and I'm thinking specifically over the past, you know, 20 years, 15 years, since 9/11, right? And it certainly sort of revved back up. And the irony is that I think, well, because, you know, Donald Trump, there were people who projected onto Donald Trump some sense of non-interventionist that I think was quickly dispelled. Who knows what he sincerely believed in his heart or head?
Yeah.
My guess is, you know, very little either way. I don't think it was on much of a foundation. But let's work backwards, okay? And start with where we are in terms of Syria. Oh, the other comment I wanted to make is, I thought the circle between our building those tunnels in Afghanistan and then.
With bin Laden's earth-moving equipment.
And then...
dropping them on ISIS.
And then dropping the bomb on it was sort of the... it's the perfect, genuine, like, almost definitional neoliberal project, right? Where you create the problem.
Yep.
And then you allow the market to solve the problem. And then you create that new one, and it just keeps itself licking ice cream cone. It's nice that way. But give us a sense
it's
of...
it's called,
like,
an opportunity, Sam.
Disruption. There was a lot of disruption on the ground. Just give us a sense of like the last month and a half, because there seems to me we had Donald Trump at one point saying he was going to. You tell us.
I'll take you back to the Obama era. There was a deep panic within the national security state. We didn't really have a powerful external enemy. Bill Kristol, who's the, you know, leading voice of neoconservatism in Washington, complained in 2014 that the American public are war weary and they need a rallying. The rallying began to arrive in Ukraine when Putin invaded Crimea after the U.S. encouraged the toppling of Ukraine's democratically elected Russian-oriented government. And, you know, a proxy war erupted there with us basically backing neo-Nazi groups like the Azov and Idar battalions. So the rallying was beginning. And then Syria was another point of rallying for the national security state. Here you have the only country in the Arab League that is a Russian client. Russia values that relationship so much. It's one of its few warm water deep ports is in Syria at Tartus. So Russia's going to do what it takes to defend this and prevent that state from collapsing. In 2012, the U.S. and its Gulf allies in Turkey initiated a program of arming proxy groups who were substantially, by that time, jihadist or Salafi jihadist or religious extremists who would have produced a disastrous result. In 2013, the rebels believed that when a chemical attack occurred in the rebel-held area of East Ghouta, east of Damascus, which was international news, still the subject of great debate, who was responsible for it. The photographs of the dead children in 2013 would trigger the red line that Obama had established, that if Assad uses chemical weapons, crosses the red line, then we have to intervene. And the rebels, that was their whole strategy from the beginning, because they couldn't defeat the Syrian army with all of its Russian backing without the U.S. Air Force and NATO. It didn't work. Obama cut a deal with Lavrov, the foreign minister of Russia. He did not want to do it. He knew what would happen. It would be another Libya with Al-Qaeda-affiliated warlords fighting with ISIS for control of the country in the middle of the Middle East. So you go down the line, 2014, 2015, the Syrian opposition, the armed opposition, starts beefing up its propaganda apparatus with Western money from USAID, from the British Foreign Office, and from the Gulf states, who are our allies. The White Helmets is one of those creations, this first responders group that was actually a Netflix vehicle, propaganda vehicle for them, won an Oscar. They were nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. And they were really used as one of the main vehicles for showing the brutality of the Assad government and demanding that the West intervene when it wasn't in the U.S.'s strategic interest to do so.
Let me just
to build up to the chemical incident of last month.
But
this month,
let me just disaggregate two things. One is, this is not to say that the Assad regime is not
absolutely
horrible and killing people, right? I mean,
absolutely.
This is simply to say, you have people who have an agenda, and they're exploiting.
They're fighting
that.
An insurgency led substantially by Al Qaeda with Vietnam era weapons in urban warfare, and thousands of people have died. I mean, the U.S. has killed more people in Syria than Russia did last year, but there's no denying that civilian homes.
Is that true? Because my understanding was that Russia was, as of maybe a month or two ago, the numbers I saw were that Russia was around. Had killed 12,000 people, and the U.S. 3,000.
It might have been this year because of the intensification of bombings under Trump.
I think that's probably.
In any case, the numbers are comparable. But there's no denying
the
brutality.
Point is, there's blood on everyone's hands.
But the context here is what's important, especially for the American public, because over 100,000 people on the government side have died as well, and this is never acknowledged. I mean, you've seen massive suffering in government areas and rebel areas.
Yes, it's on both sides.
So,
it's a horrible, horrible civil war.
But the context is what we've been denied. We've been denied we've been shown this conflict as a one-sided, a one-sided war led by this dictator who enjoys killing children for the sake of killing children. And what we ignore is that 18 million people live under the control of the Syrian government led by Bashar al-Assad. It's all been reduced to one guy, but it's a vast apparatus. 2 million people live under the rebels. 7 million people have fled rebel territory to live under the government, to avoid being under the control of al-Qaeda, which controls Idlib, which has banned music, which has banned women from wearing colorful hijab, which has banned weddings, which has carried out executions in the town square. All of the Christian families were driven out or slaughtered when the rebels took over Idlib. The Druze population of Idlib was forced to convert and dig up their own shrines or be executed on the spot. And that's what we saw in East Aleppo as well. We hear Samantha Power pining for Aleppo, but no one talks about why this is happening, who's there, and East Aleppo, which was controlled by Al-Qaeda and a Salafist group called Ahrar al-Sham and some Western-backed groups, was right next door to West Aleppo, where the majority of the population lived under government control. So what does the government do? I mean, it's an impossible situation, but we've been denied any context.
I mean, I you've obviously are a lot more well-read and reported on this. I would say another potential scenario, I imagine some of those people, the civilians who are, and there's a huge, obviously, internal and external refugee problem. Part of it is, I'm going to go, if I have to, I want to be in the area that is not going to get bombed by an Air Force.
Right, right. It just chaos takes place
and,
there.
And so there's some value, it's hard to disaggregate why people are leaving. For the main part, I think it's just they want to get away from where the bombs are. But
if you're Shia, if you're Christian, you want to get away from where the genocidal rebels that the U.S. has backed are as well.
Absolutely. And, let me ask you this, and then we can. I want to go forward here to just the sort of the changes in. One thing that seems to have coming out of this to a large extent is Barack Obama, for all his faults in terms of expanding the war in Yemen and in Somalia and maintaining it in Afghanistan, when all of this started happening with Syria, I really got the sense that, like, wow, there was a lot of people around him who really wanted to go into Syria.
Yep, yep.
And as far as I could tell, like, he didn't want to.
No.
And I'm not convinced that that deal that he cut with Lavrov, that started with John Kerry saying something that was supposedly a mistaken thing to say, like, we would cut a deal, supposedly a throwaway. That to me sounds like a guy who's trying to go around a fairly big apparatus. That maybe that offhand comment wasn't so offhand. I mean, do you have a sense of that? Because I'm just looking at this in hindsight.
I mean, you are going up against not only, Raytheon, which has made a killing since 2011, shipping anti-tank TOW missiles to the Syrian rebels, and was the designer. Its stock surged after the cruise missile strike on the Shayrat airbase that Trump recently authorized, because it makes the Tomahawk cruise missiles. You're going up against the CIA, which was overseeing the arm and equip program for the rebels. You're going up against the Defense Department, which had very little interest in diplomacy with the Assad government. And you're going up against, at this point, you're going up against the liberal media, which is consumed in this Russia hysteria. And the only time that it was willing to celebrate anything Trump did, and, I don't think there's anything to celebrate there, was when he bombed the Syrian government. It's the only way Trump can move out of his face.
I wouldn't say just the liberal media. I would say
the mainstream media as well.
Largely
the whole media, Fox News.
Yeah.
Sure, but it is significant that liberals were celebrating Trump. Anne-Marie Slaughter, who is Hillary's director of policy planning.
I was on Hayes' program with someone from the Brookings Institute, who I've been told otherwise is pretty good, but they all had this notion of, we need to bomb, and then we just need to have a smart strategy to follow it. And I'm like, where's this smart strategy going to come from?
There is no strategy. I mean, that's what Kerry understood, and this is what Obama understood. And at the... while they understood.
And can I just say, is the argument here that it is not one which is saying that Assad is a good guy, or but just that there's nothing for the United States to do in this context to mitigate this this civil war, essentially?
We've sent over 1/15 of the CIA's budget has been spent on arming extremist rebels who are in an alliance with Al-Qaeda in Syria. And it's those TOW anti-tank missiles that have kept this conflict going. It's not a revolution when these extremist groups are openly declaring their intention to establish an exclusively Sunni Islamic state in a very diverse country. That's the agenda. So what the U.S. has done is kept the conflict alive, spawned a refugee crisis, sanctioned the country so that, like, for example, child cancer drugs, which were previously subsidized by the state, aren't available. And it spread this catastrophe to the West, with just a massive refugee crisis coming to Europe. The arming of the rebels created space for ISIS to emerge in eastern Syria. There would be no ISIS in Syria had we not armed rebel groups so substantially. We're talking about $1 billion a year. That's just from the U.S. That's not counting the Gulf states and Turkey and what they're doing to tear this country apart. Now, from the neoconservative perspective or the liberal interventionist perspective, even if you don't bomb, you still get a good result because you're weakening a Russian ally, a country that had no relationship with the United States, was in many ways adversarial to Israel, but you're not removing its government. So there's still enough stability that these Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups so that they don't fully take over. So it's I look at it in terms of prolongation, just the systematic weakening and destruction of a country. And for the people who live there,
this is the sort of the PNAC, the Project New American Century. Let's have a bunch of low-level conflicts because they're much more manageable. They diminish all the players involved and create us as a hyperpower.
And you and I were out there during the Iraq War. You know, Air America was against it. We were all against it. All the liberals were against it. History's repeating itself, and they're not against it this time. There's no counter-narrative, and it's really disturbing to me. This is a neoconservative agenda.
Do you think... Here's what concerns me, and then we don't have too much time,
so I want
to get to. What concerns me is not that there's an appetite now, because I don't think there is a big appetite amongst the American public to do this, and I don't think even broadly based, but I do feel like when we were about to bomb Syria, I did get that like really sinking feeling, like, holy cow.
It could happen again.
It turned on a dime, and my biggest fear is like, if there's a terrorist attack, all of this stuff, like everybody's got, they're locked and loaded, essentially.
Yep.
And that to me seems to be the biggest threat. Not so much that we're going to engage, because I just don't think there's the stomach for that at this point, but that we're potentially one major terrorist attack away from falling into the exact same pattern as that happened 17 years
ago. Well, we underestimate the role the Orlando massacre in San Bernardino played in Trump's election. And then we don't look at the roots of those attacks? Do we listen to what Omar Mateen, the Orlando killer, said in his calls to a police negotiator? It was all about Syria, and he was declaring his solidarity with the rebels, ISIS and Al-Qaeda, in Syria against the Syrian government and Russia. He was very moved and upset by what was happening there, in addition to being an obvious psychopath. But this instability that we've created in the Middle East is not going to be limited to the Middle East, and it's consistently taking
our... I think what's also important is because the counter argument to we shouldn't bomb is, well, what's your plan then? And I think it is important, frankly, for those people who don't want war to provide a plan to mitigate this horror. And it seems to me to be directly tied to the external refugees. I mean, to the extent that we have a national security interest in this, it's that this conflict does not destabilize essentially the world. And it seems to me that that destabilization comes from the pressure that is put on Europe and that entire region, broader than Europe, from the displacement of refugees. And there should be a plan for us to sink $1 billion a month into dealing with those refugees through Turkey, through essentially up into Europe.
Yeah, I mean, we've spent significantly more money on weapons sales than on refugee aid, but the real plan needs to start with a negotiated settlement involving the Syrian government, ending this fantasy of regime change, and bringing stability back to that country, starting reconstruction, letting people live in their homes, involving the commanders on the ground. There's no discussion of it. And
Hasn't there been some attempt at a negotiation?
Well, let me just make this one interesting point, which is that the day of the chemical attacks in Khan Sheikhoun in rebel-controlled Idlib, which triggered Trump's bombing, that day, diplomats, the foreign ministers of the EU, the Gulf states, were meeting in Brussels to discuss reconstruction in Syria for the first time over the stringent objections of the Syrian armed opposition. And I thought that was an interesting coincidence in timing. It was about time they talked about it, and it was all sabotaged with one very mysterious chemical attack.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was interesting, I think, maybe that it got the attention that it got. I mean, we had Assad, I think, was using chlorine bombs.
I mean, yeah, he's accused of using chlorine, but so the rebels have used chlorine
I'm not.
It's like, and it's a weird sub. It's not, there's no military value to it. But the point is, he was kicking the rebels' asses all over Syria. They were just getting crushed. They'd been removed from their base in Aleppo. Why upend all of that and put yourself in the crosshairs of the U.S. and the West all over again by authorizing a chemical attack? It just doesn't have any strategic logic.
The only explanation I could find is that there's an analog between Trump and Tillerson basically saying, backing off. I mean, it seems to me the Obama policy was, we're for regime change. We're just not going to do much about it.
Right.
And that Trump and Tillerson came out a week before and said, we're not even for regime change.
Amazing.
We've got to let the Syrian people decide.
Right.
Which to me sounds like let the war continue. And maybe the message is misunderstood by Assad. Like, handcuffs are off. And the fact is that, you know, if you're a brutal dictator, or whether or not you're a, you know, brutal jihadist force, I mean, there's a reason. There's no strategic value to chopping heads off, although it scares the heck out of people.
Well, for propaganda value,
well, yes,
it attracts foreign fighters.
And from Assad's perspective, there's a certain propaganda value to saying, like, do you want this to happen to your kids? I don't know.
I mean, I just think at that point in the conflict, with Russia fully invested, his back is not against the wall anymore. The conflict was moving to a denouement. And as you mentioned, the U.S. had reversed the longstanding policy of regime change. The rebels were being defunded by the U.S. Up until 2015, the U.S. had funded a group called Nur ed-Din al-Zenki, which is an extremist Salafist group. It was supplying it with TOW missiles, and they entered into a coalition with Jabhat al-Nusra, which is the al-Qaeda affiliate, whose leadership has sworn loyalty to Ayman al-Zawahiri, bin Laden's number two. The U.S. was funding this group, supplying it with weapons until 2015. This is one of the great scandals of our times that hasn't been exposed. And it really took until, I think, February, when Reuters reported that the arms shipments had finally stopped from Turkey. So this is another factor. They're getting disarmed. They're being defeated on the battlefield. Diplomacy is starting. The U.S. reverses the policy of regime change, and then a chemical attack occurs. So again, I don't understand from the Assad regime. It would be suicidal. And of course, in war, governments and armies do really stupid things. So.
Right. I mean, for all we know, it could have been one person on the ground, local commander saying, like...
Sure. And, like in Chechnya that happened. Yeah. But, you know, the reason I'm ranting is because we've just been denied all of this context. And I think the American public would benefit from actually knowing some of the history and knowing that the group that is leading the Syrian armed opposition right now is in a coalition called Hayat Tahrir al-Sham. In 2015, they produced a video celebrating the 9/11 attacks on their official channel. I mean, why are we involved in supporting them? Why should we provide them with air support? Where's the national security value? The fact is that our national security state, which is kind of known as the deep state these days, and I think that's an accurate term, is willing to sacrifice national security imperatives, the safety of the American public, for imperial designs. And that's what it's done in Syria.
Yeah, and I think, you know, this dynamic, I mean, look, every interview I have here when I come to this, is about decisions that are made by large entities that involving billions of dollars, where the deaths or injuries or widespread misery of people are, really only an issue insofar as how much will they have to compensate if they get caught doing it 10 years later, and it's just simply a fraction of what the revenue is, and it's just part of doing business. And on some level, there's no reason to think that people working in those industries in the context of our government don't share some of those incentive structures.
Yeah, I mean, it's the revolving door. That's another key factor of the culture of the deep state. And you saw the Washington Post publish a editorial in support, I forget the name of the author, in support of Trump's cruise missile strike on Syria. Didn't mention that that author, there's no acknowledgement at all in the piece that the author of that piece was a lobbyist for Raytheon, which is the maker of the cruise missiles. I mean, that's the level we're at.
They were just proud about their missiles.
Well, if they're proud, then say I'm a lobbyist for it. Like, don't hide that.
Well, they're proud, but also humble.
Yeah, there's a lot of humility there. That's a good... but you know.
All right. So lastly, all right, just give me a sense. How do you think Trump's disposition on Syria changed? And is that where you think, like, is Syria going to be the focus? Like, why is he just freelancing with North Korea? Like, give me your sense.
Yeah, I think we've been pushed into a dangerous situation because of, for purely domestic reasons, because of the post-election atmosphere that started with the hysteria that Paul Krugman kind of inaugurated when he declared without any evidence that Russia hacked our election, and this kind of hysteria.
I mean, do you concede? I mean, I listen, I think there was a half a dozen reasons why Clinton lost. I mean, it's a very a small margin. And I would put Russia maybe number 7 out of those half a dozen, frankly. I mean, if it's at all.
Well, we have to have some proof somewhere. And
but do you
I
think there is
it.
No, I mean, at this point, do you think, I mean, I've seen multiple, you know, congressional leaders come out of these hearings saying, you know, Adam Schiff has gone to say, like, you know, it's not just circumstantial. There's
yeah, that was a shocking testimony by Schiff to me.
I mean, that to me sounds like they have some genuine, or do you know, are you more skeptical about
it? Well, when I go into go and look at his sources and get really granular with it, it looks like a gigantic scam on a greater level than Iraqi WMDs, because they didn't even have to try that hard. It was still, 9/11 was still fresh and people were just willing to go along with it. But I mean, one of his sources was CrowdStrike, which is a cyber firm that's a for-profit cyber firm run by a Russian exile who's a fellow at the Atlantic Council, which is substantially funded by Viktor Pinchuk, the Ukrainian billionaire, close friend of the Clintons. And he's created this whole, you know, Ukrainian nationalist division at one of the biggest think tanks in Washington to push this anti-Russian narrative. One of those fellows is the head of CrowdStrike. His co-founder is an former FBI agent who's an NBC contributor who comes and talks about all of the Russian hacking. And if you look at the report that they issued, which was paid for by the DNC.
Who's that? The second one?
CrowdStrike.
Was it Malcolm Nance the second guy or no?
No. Malcolm Nance is such a, I mean, this guy, there's no credibility there. But these people at least look credible. They have some expertise in cyber warfare. But you look at you read the paper, and it's like, first of all, if you're not an expert in cybersecurity, you can't even understand the jargon.
Right.
But then you see that there's so many contradictions. They say that these hackers, Fancy Bear from Russia, were experts at covering their tracks, but they left some key evidence by coding in Cyrillic. Okay, if they're experts at covering their tracks, why would you code in Cyrillic and leave behind tracks? Doesn't add up. Then they issued another report in December claiming that Fancy Bear and the Russian, you know, the FSB, the Russian security service, had hacked into Ukraine's an app that the Ukrainian military used to control its artillery pieces, that they had lost 80% of their artillery in eastern Ukraine from Russian separatists. And the Ukrainian military came out and said, that's a total lie. We've only lost 15% of our pieces. Nothing was hacked. And the report was condemned so much that it was retracted. So this firm to me that Schiff is citing, which is for-profit, is totally has an ulterior motive, is not credible. None of this stuff is credible. And then beyond that, when James Comey, the FBI director, asked for access to the DNC server that was specifically hacked, the DNC said, no, we're going to pay this shady for-profit firm instead to give us the result we want. We can't risk it.
Why
with Comey.
Why do you think Comey initiated the investigation with the Trump people? Put aside the hacking of the election. Like I say, I don't think that's important. Do you think that there is no? Do you think that the stuff with Flynn and Manafort is all just ginned up? Is that it?
Oh, the Manafort issue is fascinating. I mean, the guy was a complete slimeball, but here's what he was doing. he was working for Yanukovych, who was the democratically elected Russian-friendly prime minister of Ukraine, right? He was not Russian. And Manafort was just lobbying for him like he'd lobbied for Jonas Savimbi, the Angolan warlord who killed like 500,000 people. Nobody cares that Manafort worked for Jonas Savimbi because Savimbi was the number two CIA proxy next to the Afghan Mujahideen. He's our friend. He was our bastard.
He didn't get the emails either.
Yanukovych was not our friend, but John Podesta, Hillary Clinton's chief of staff through the Podesta Group, was also simultaneously lobbying for Yanukovych. He was introduced to Yanukovych and his party of the regions by Paul Manafort. So they're all working together in this ring of sleaze. And then what happened was, I mean, I don't know how much detail you want or how much time we have. But
we don't have much more time.
But I just don't see with Manafort anything more sinister than the filth that we that's familiar to the Beltway.
All right, fair enough. So just give me a brief encapsulation, because I got another guest.
A brief encapsulation? Well, listen to what Ben Cardin said. He keeps saying this. This is the Democratic senator from Maryland, very liberal guy, and he says, "We have been attacked by Russia. It was an act of war, and we must respond." It's that kind of rhetoric that I think created the atmosphere behind the bombing of Syria, and it's cultivated an atmosphere of at least brinksmanship in the Korean Peninsula. That's just really terrifying to me.
And let me just add that in terms of like the politics of this, if the worst thing you can say, if the way that you convince the American public that Donald Trump and Republican control of our government is bad because Russia hacked our election.
Yeah, there's a lot of bad stuff there.
It seems to me that you've lost the thread a little bit.
Well, it allows the Democratic leadership to attack Trump without having to do anything remotely progressive.
Or even political. You don't have to institute any policy.
Sure. It papers over their own failures so they can stay in place. And it subsumed the left. All these movements that were taking place in 2016, Standing Rock, Black Lives Matter, the whole Bernie movement. It's just been subsumed by this narrative.
I think, there was a certain inevitability. That's the tough thing. We saw this during the Bush years, right? Like, there was no... The left itself could not grow because it was really about getting rid. And that dynamic is, there's a certain inevitability to that dynamic, which is, frankly, why one of the major reasons why I didn't want Donald Trump to win was because we had a nascent, I think, but growing left in this country. All right, well, Max, we got to continue this conversation in the future, but people should check out your work. It's The Gray Zone.
Yeah, Alternet. .org/grayzoneproject, and we're putting up original reporting and analysis every day that you're not going to see anywhere else, including in progressive media, on the national security state, Islamophobia, and Trump's foreign policy.
All right. Well, someday we got to talk about Sam Harris, but
if you got another half hour, we can go.
I would love to, but I've got somebody here, but we got to do that.
Thanks a lot,
Max. Thanks so much.
All right.